Please call the roll.
Maria DeAnda?
Here.
Darren Garrett?
Here.
Ron Martin?
Here.
Jim DeMartini?
Here.
Jeff Grover?
Here.
Michael O'Neill?
Here.
Jigan Raja?
Yes.
Mike Lynch?
Here.
Donna Riley?
Here.
Joan Clendenin? We have a quorum.
Okay, do we have any announcements? Seeing none, we will move to public comment. This is the time you can comment on anything that is not on the agenda. Any public comments? That's your big opportunity. Okay, seeing none, we will move to consent items. Does any member of this board wish to pull an item that's on the consent calendar? Okay, seeing none, I will entertain a motion to approve.
So moved.
A motion's been made and seconded that we approve the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion is carried.
Michael, was that your second? Thank you.
Okay, Executive Director's Report. Six.
Sackers Memorandum. Kelly Cerny is going to present this.
Basically, all this is the final ballot to be voted on at the Sackers Business Meeting by our, you guys had already nominated Darren to be your voting delegate and Maria to be the alternate. And so this is the final ballot. And if you approve it, then they will vote on it accordingly at the business meeting at Sackers. So I just need a motion and a second to approve the ballot.
Okay, motion's been made. Second?
Second.
Is there any discussion on this item? We went through this pretty fast. Okay, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carried. Okay. Item 6B.
Okay.
Board study session. Okay.
This is the last of the study sessions that we're going to talk about risk and pension funding. Then we're going to move on to different investment strategies. Probably starting in June or July, and that'll probably take a few months. So this is the last one. We're going to talk about the discount rate today. This is kind of a hot topic. It's been a hot topic for the last 10 years, and actually it shouldn't be a very long presentation either. So first off, what is a discount rate? Well, it's an interest rate that's used to place a value or a cost on a payment today that's made tomorrow. And the reason I emphasize value or cost here is because this is pretty much the crux of the disagreement in what discount rate to use. There's two camps of folks that are both purporting different uses and different discount rates, and that's what we're going to discuss today. And if we look at the definition of cost and value, you can see that there is a definite difference between the two terms. Cost is what someone would actually pay, money that they would actually put out. And value is more along the lines of a relative worth, what's something actually worth. It doesn't necessarily mean that somebody who actually kicked down the money for that good or service, whatever it is. And again, that really gets down to what the heart of the disagreement is between the two camps. So the two basic perspectives, we'll distinguish them today by calling the first the financial economics camp. The second one, I was thinking this morning, I probably should have called it the actuarial camp, but it's basically, I'm going to call it funding instead of the actuarial side. The financial economics side is a value-based calculation, and this is the reason why. The study of financial economics is essentially trying to place a value on an asset. And financial economics says that if there's an asset that's traded in a market that's not liquid, that there really is no market value to that asset, then one can find the value of that asset by looking at other assets in liquid markets that have the same type of payouts and the same characteristics as the asset that you're looking at. So it derives its value on illiquid assets based on assets that they can actually get a good price on out in deep and liquid markets. It's a liability-driven calculation because none of the financial economists actually say that that you should be funding using these types of assets. They're only looking at the liability that these assets produce, or that these liabilities produce. And so what they say is you're supposed to use the yield curve to value these liabilities, these future payments. On the other hand, the actuaries use the expected return on assets on the portfolio that one invests in. It's more of a contribution-driven analysis. And so the, well, we'll get into this later. I don't have to, this is just an overview of it right here. So financial economics, their premise is that government pensions are a sure thing. They say that the benefit is going to be paid, that the employees are going to get is going to be paid come hell or high water, essentially. And so what they say, based on financial economics, is that the value of that pension should be based on a similar asset. Well, they can find similar assets in government bonds. In government bonds, you could find bonds that have payouts about the same time as your pension benefits are. They have the same, you can buy bonds that pay out the same amount that the pension benefit will later on down the road. And essentially, the theory is that the government bonds are a sure thing. So they're going to be paid, they're essentially riskless. And so having said that, since the financial economists think that pensions are pretty much the same payments or pay the same way as a government bond do, they say to use the yield curve to value the liabilities. So this is essentially a snapshot of the yield curve on March 20th of 2012, and this is what the government pays to borrow money. And so a financial economist would say that, let's say a payment that's made, let's say a $100 payment that's made in 20 years from now, you should use a discount rate of 3.13%, because that's what the government has to pay. And again, it's a that $1,000 payment or $100 payment that's going to be made in 20 years to a pensioner is considered a sure thing. You can't really get out of making that payment. And so it's a big difference between 8% and 3.13%. And in fact, if one did the math, you'd see that there's a $33 difference in the present value of that $100 payment in terms of today's dollars. So it's a huge difference. Now, there is one interesting thing, is that when this last Stanford study came out, the one that we looked at a couple months ago, Stanford study said that pensions across up and down the state should be using a 5% discount rate. Well, the financial economists have kind of changed their tune over the last couple of years. And what they're saying is that now they're assuming that government pensions up and down the state aren't necessarily a sure thing anymore, that municipalities and local governments could actually default. And so they now are suggesting that instead of using a yield curve or a government treasury curves, that they should use a curve that's more in line with what the local governments or the municipalities have to pay. And so they came up with a weighted average of about 5% across the entire local government yield curve. And so that's why they've upped that a little bit. There are some problems with financial economics. One of them is that the proponents of this concept don't do a good job of explaining what it is they're trying to say. Financial economists are not saying that traditional portfolios can't earn what they have in the past. They can't say that because nobody really knows for sure what these types of portfolios are saying. They're saying they're not saying that plans can't earn this equity risk premium that generally an investor historically has earned by investing in stocks over bonds. What they're saying is don't take credit for that equity risk premium until you've actually earned it. And they're also not saying that you should invest in these types of assets to fund. They're just saying to report the liabilities based on this lower discount rate. The problem is that there are some people who are grabbing onto their discussion, their liability numbers, and they are saying that pension plans are going to have to make this payment no matter what, this payment based on, or this liability number based on this low discount rate. And that's only if the assets earned that very low discount rate. It's probably not very likely that the traditional portfolio is going to earn 3.5% to 4% over the next 30 to 40 years. But some are using the financial economics argument their liability number to say that the pension plans are going to have to pay that no matter what. So again, they're not saying that we can't earn what we think we can earn, and they're not saying to fund pension plans that way. They're just saying on an from an economic perspective, this is the value of the liability. And we'll see another slide that kind of makes that a little more clear later on.
Is that a point in time?
At a point in time, yes. In other words, the value of that liability, absolutely. That thing changes every day as the yield curve changes. The other problem with their argument is that they've not addressed the liquidity of the benefits. When you or I get a pension benefit from a retirement system, let's say it's before I retire, let's say I've accrued 20 years of service, and I'm going to get a benefit. I can't turn around and sell that benefit for what it's worth. In fact, I'm probably going to only get 50 cents on the dollar if I refund, because I'm only going to get my contributions with a small amount of interest. So that benefit that I've earned up to a certain point in time is not worth as much as it's being valued, because I can't sell it for that value. On the other hand, a government bond can. It's very liquid. It's very marketable. I can always turn around and sell it at a moment's notice at what the market is willing to pay for that benefit. And because I can do that as an investor in a government bond, the interest rate that I'm going to earn is very low, because I've got a lot of liquidity. When you purchase an asset, like a private equity asset, you're going to expect to receive a higher rate of interest, because you may not get your money out of that asset for 4 or 5 years. And so the interest rate that you earn is actually higher.
Unless it's a Greek bond.
Yeah. So I guess the bottom line is that to simply use a treasury curve to value a government pension doesn't account for the fact that one can't sell that benefit. So that's an issue that they haven't really touched upon. It's been proposed and talked about, but they've really not come forth with any answer as to, you know, how you should compensate for that lack of liquidity. So now we'll turn to the actuarial funding side. It's pretty easy. Essentially, the actuary assumes that asset returns are predictable, that they can predict what asset returns are going to be over very long periods of time. And they also, very importantly, assume that the plan sponsor will be able to make those contributions. So what the actuary is really trying to do is, if you look at the conclusion and you look at the formulas down at the bottom, it says that contributions plus investment returns equals benefits. Well, if you rearrange that formula, you have contributions equal benefits less returns. What the actuary is trying to do ultimately in his job is figure out what the contributions are. He's trying to determine how much money the pension plan needs to be able to pay benefits and to sustain itself going forward. The benefits are defined. That's what a defined benefit is. The actuary has a really good idea of what the benefits are going to be over the life of the plan. That's not a hard thing to predict. So to calculate the contributions, he's got to make some assumption on what the returns are going to be over the life of the plan. And so what better return assumption to use other than what's expected to be earned on the portfolio? If the actuary were to use a return based on, let's say, what the financial economists want to use, a very riskless return, he would calculate, and then the pension plan would take those contributions and invest them in a portfolio, a traditional portfolio like we do. Over time, you're going to be overfunding the plan, because the contributions are going to be based on a portfolio that earns, you know, let's say 3 or 4%, a riskless portfolio. But the portfolio is going to turn around and they're going to invest those assets in a portfolio that's expected to earn 7 or 8%. So the actuary is only trying to determine the calculations based on what he or she thinks the returns are going to be. And that's why the actuary uses, as a discount rate, the return expected on the portfolio of assets. He's trying to fund the benefits based on what the portfolio is going to earn over a long period of time.
And isn't it also big? I mean, they have to use history as a benchmark, right?
Correct.
But history is not necessarily a good predictor of the future.
That's right.
And that's where they get off track.
Yeah, but that's not the reason for the difference in the two camps here at all. Okay. That's totally not. I mean, I hear what you're saying. You're saying, well, you know, based on what's happened in the last few years, that things going forward aren't going to be what they have been historically. And that's true. The actuary will consider that. He'll look at what's happened over the last, you know, 10, 20, 30 years and come up with a discount rate. But then he'll also use some subjective judgment and lowering that going forward based on, you know, what's happened in the past. The financial economist, when he comes up with his or her discount rate, doesn't care about what capital markets, what equities are going to do. He only looks at where interest rates are today, and that's how they come up with their discount rate, whatever the yield curve says it is. So he doesn't actually have to do any predicting in terms of equities or capital markets going forward, which makes his job a little easier.
If they change the benefit calculation, it changes the equation.
Well, yeah, sure, absolutely. And that's why when you do an analysis, if the plan sponsor were to enhance benefits, then he's going to change that, and that's going to up the contribution side as well. There are problems in the actuary's way of doing business. Here's really what the economic value of a liability really is. The problem is that if the employee were to go out and buy the annuity that he or she is going to receive at retirement, he or she is going to have to pay a lot more money from a private insurer to get that annuity later on. And the reason is because the insurer is the insurer of that benefit. If the assets don't perform, the insurer has to pay that annuity no matter what. And so the insurer wants to be compensated for taking on that risk. He knows that he has to pay that benefit out regardless. And so he's going to use a value, he's going to use a discount rate, an interest rate that's much, much more conservative. He's not going to assume that he's going to earn 8% on his money and charge you for that present value. He's going to assume that he's going to earn much, much less. So you are compensating him, the insurer, for taking on that risk. The liability number that the actuary calculates does not incorporate that risk that the plan sponsor, the county, is on the hook for paying these benefits. If the assets don't perform, then the county has to pay more in contributions. If the employees live longer than the actuary assumes, the county has to pay more money. So as an individual, I guess I would ask this, to kind of come up for what you think the value of your benefit is, think about, would you, at retirement, would you sell your benefit for the liability figure that's being calculated in the valuation? Would you be willing to take that money and invest it on your own and hope you don't run out of money or make bad investments and be able to, and would you take on the longevity risk, the fact that you may live to be 100 years old? Would you take on that risk? The answer is probably not. Well, there's a value to that. The county is covering that. The plan sponsor is covering that, and there's a value to that. And that's the difference between the financial economist number and the number that the actuary uses.
Well, the insurance company is also calculating in a profit margin, too.
Absolutely. You're probably paying probably even more than a discount rate based on treasuries. Absolutely.
Right.
Because they do have a profit margin. Plus, they have a mortality cost, too.
Correct.
To throw in a premium for mortality, bad mortality experience. The other problem is the assets may not earn what's expected. In fact, the assets are never going to earn exactly what the actuary thinks are going to be earned. And so if the assets don't earn, if they earn less than what the actuary assumes, then we are understating the liabilities over a long period of time. And the contribution rates are too low. There is something that offsets or mitigates that, though, is that over time, as experience unfolds and the portfolio doesn't earn what the actuary thinks, he's going to continue to ratchet the rate up. So that's not necessarily such a bad thing. And the liability value will continue to increase as well as the actual experience is realized over time. But nonetheless, there are some issues with that liability number as well. So here's another, maybe a better way of looking at the difference between the two. Let's say you had a $1,000 liability that you had to pay in a year from now. Well, the question is, and you want to set aside money to pay for it today. The question is, how much should I set aside today? Well, that depends on how much risk you want to take. You can invest in an equity that's expected to earn 10%. And so if that's the case, if you wanted to take on that investment, you'd throw down $909 today. If the equity earned 10%, you'd have your $1,000 in a year from now. However, if I didn't think I could make up the difference, let's say the equity underperformed, let's say I lost 20% and I only ended up with, let's say $720 after a year from now, can you make up that difference if the equity does lose 20%? That's a question that you have to ask when you decide how much risk you want to take on. And so in this example, the difference between an equity that pays 10% and a bond that pays 1%, the price, the insurance to eliminate that risk and to make sure you have $1,000 a year from now is $81. And so really when it comes down to determining the discount rate, from a funding perspective and from a financial economics perspective, you really have to ask yourself the question, how much risk do I want to take in trying to pay that benefit later on down the road? And that's what pension plans have to ask themselves, how much risk they want to take. And that's kind of what we've seen in the past few years, is when the markets have underperformed, then the actuary comes back and continues to ask the pension plan for more contributions. And that, again, is the question that the pension plan and the sponsors have to understand and have to ask themselves is, can I handle those periods of time when the markets underperform and the actuary comes back and continues to ask for more and more money? It's just a function of risk and reward. So, which measure is right? Well, really, they both are. And it depends on which story you're trying to tell. On the financial economics side, if you're trying to report the economic value or the true conferred value or the value that's being conferred to the employees, what they're really getting in terms of a market value, then the financial economics number is correct. In other words, that number kind of gives an idea to the employees what they're getting and what they would have to pay if they actually went out and bought this from an insurance company, or how much money they'd have to put up front themselves to cover the risk of outliving your money and of your assets underperforming. You need a heck of a lot more money because interest rates are so low right now to ensure that benefit. It's good for comparing pension systems. If everybody used the same number, obviously that funded ratios that would come out of those calculations would be comparable across all pension systems. And then finally, and this is really an important thing, and it's kind of a shame that, 10, 12 years ago when plan sponsors were enhancing benefits when all the surpluses existed, is that they did bargain on the funding, the actuarial liability, which again, it did not compensate the plan sponsor for taking on that risk. We tried to, or I tried to explain that several times in the early 2000s, but try to tell that to somebody who has a lot of surplus in their plan at that time, and when the cost is going from zero before the plan enhancement to zero afterwards, nobody listens. Nobody cares, because they're able to give away, or they're able to, say, get salary concessions from employees at that time for enhanced benefits. So it looks like a really good deal, but in reality, they still weren't being compensated for the risk that they were taking later on down the road, and that risk bore itself out 3 or 4 years later.
Rick, isn't even worse, though, like if there's a 25% decline in the assets, and it falls on the employer in a public agency situation, their only source of revenue is cut in staff. I mean, especially if you're in Prop 13 counties and stuff. So,
yes.
So you're going to be cutting staff, which means you're going to be also reducing your employee contribution.
That's right.
So it's even kind of a...
It's a vicious cycle, and then it just ratchets up the employee contribution as well. And you add to that a shrinking payroll base, and they're funding this pension plan. Liabilities don't decrease that much. You're funding this pension plan over a shrinking payroll base, and the contributions go up even more.
And take it one step further, and the chance of getting to insolvency is that much easier in that scenario.
Yes. I mean,
in this day and age, it's a very, very much a reality.
Yeah. I mean, anytime you have a dollar less of an asset to fund the liability, the risk of insolvency gets worse.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, Joe. You were going to say something, Joe?
Well, PERS reduce their discount rate. And when they reduce their discount rate, the funding, the percentage of funding for the system went down. So the risk to the employer the state, the taxpayer, goes up.
The risk? I don't think so. Here's why. I understand what you're saying, and this is one of the problems that when you see this in the paper, that the funding ratio decreased because they lowered the discount rate. Think about this. If you go back, that's a good question, but if you go back to this one right here, contributions equals benefit minus returns. Before they lowered the discount rate, the benefits don't change before and after they lower the discount rate, right?
No.
They don't change. They're the same. So what you have is you have a system that has a bucket of benefits that it has to pay, and it's going to pay those benefits with assets that are sitting over here, okay? When you lower the...
Present day assets.
Yeah, right. When you lower the discount rate at that point in time, and the funded ratio does change because the liability changes, the risk of the plan doesn't change. The assets are the same, and the benefits are the same. So the risk of the plan at that point in time that they lowered the discount rate doesn't change, even though the funding ratio changes. What happens is the solvency, the betterment of the plan gets better over time. But when the paper sit here and quote that when the system changed the discount rate, that it's in a worse shape now, that's crap.
Okay. What if I change risk to liability?
I don't know. What do you mean?
Well, if the funding ratio goes from 100% to 83% because they changed the discount rate,
okay.
Then that means that the state, which is the taxpayer, is liable for the difference if it has to...
It means the plan's going to be asking for more money going forward.
So it seems to me that there's an incentive for a system like PERS to reduce the discount rate, because then its members don't have to contribute as much, and the state has to make up the difference whether the state wants to or not.
And
the same principle could apply to counties or...
The members, it doesn't matter with the members, because the member contribution rate is set by statutes no matter what the employer has to pay within the CalPERS system. So that doesn't matter. So the only thing you're doing is you're upping contributions from the employer when CalPERS does that.
Right.
So when you lower the discount rate for the state, it's not as much of a risk because the state can't become insolvent. But when you lower the discount rate for our organization, the county can become insolvent, so it increases the chance of insolvency for the government, the plan sponsor.
For the lower levels of government?
When you lower the discount rate, it increases the risk of insolvency for the plan sponsor.
There's more pressure on the plan sponsor.
That's
because they
saying.
Have to pay more contributions going forward.
Okay. Wouldn't the employee also have to increase their contributions
in our system, yes. Yeah. PERS, no, though, but in our system, yes, because when you change the discount rate, that's like changing an assumption, and then the actuary goes back and recalculates the employee contribution rates. So the employee bears some of the brunt in our system.
Because it's bifurcated on the funding.
Exactly. But at CalPERS, it's set by statute, and the employee contribution rate doesn't change.
So if we lowered the discount rate or decided to for whatever reason, we could expect the employers and the employees to see an upward tick.
That's correct. That is correct.
Less cops and less spending ability on the part of the employees.
Exactly. Yeah, and they lay off people.
I think we're just going to have to figure a balance. What is a good balance, the right level of risk to take to fund these benefits? I really think that that's the most important decision or the biggest criteria that we should undertake or think about when we look at changing the discount rate. And that's kind of what the last slide talks about. Whoops. Why would you change a discount rate? Well, we don't even need to spend any time on that first one. Financial economics, when the interest rates change, then so does the discount rate. Funding, there's two primary reasons to change. It's if your outlook on capital markets have changed, economic growth, inflation, so forth. And I think that those are things we are going to look at, but I also think that we need to, like I just said, we need to consider how much risk the organization wants to take and how much risk the county wants to take. And we will be doing that probably over the next 4 to 6 months. That's all I have.
Rick, one other thing, and I can't remember the facts or figures, but now that for new employees, new hires as of what, a year and a half ago, they go back to the old Tier 2 system, for example. So now you really have two sets of potential liabilities.
Right.
So the employer-employee contributions are set based on what they expect to pay, or are they somehow related at all to what the current longstanding employees are at?
Both. So it considers the liabilities that currently exist within the plan, specifically the unfunded liabilities, and it also considers the cost of the future benefit accruals that are going to occur for the people who are still under the Tier 1 benefit. Those are going to occur for probably 30 more years, 30 to 40 more years. There's probably some folks that were hired a couple years ago that are in their early 20s and are going to work till they're 60, 65. And then it's also going to combine those costs with the new folks that are coming in after January 1st of 2011 under the second tier that are going to be earning benefits under the lower formula.
So I guess what I'm thinking of, since is as the Tier 5 folks get older and retire from and stay retired for the next 30 years, the new employees that have 40 work years left, their contributions are basically sustaining that other pile. And is it at such a level that's commensurate with that need, or just based on this formula?
That's a good question. I mean, the actuary is going to incorporate the present value of all those future retirement payments to the Tier 1 folks into the contribution rates. I'm sorry, Tier 5. I'm thinking just one and two tiers. But Tiers 4 and 5, he's going to incorporate those future benefits, and he's going to look at the payroll of the new tier coming forward, and he's going to calculate a rate based on those two things. The nice thing is about having the new tiers, Tier 2, is that the cash flow demands on the system, it may not seem like it right now, but the cash flow demands on the system are going to be reduced later on going forward, and it's going to make it a little bit easier to fund the system.
Which potentially could mean fewer employees at that time, say 20 years down the road.
You think so?
Well, I don't know. It depends.
It'd be the reverse. But
yeah, I would think that you'd almost...
There's less drain on the plan sponsoring.
What is the definition of a little bit later?
Yeah, but I mean, if you have a smaller base of employees paying into it, either those contribution rates are going to have to go up for them later on as we move forward and are recalculated.
Well, payroll shouldn't... I don't think there'd be any difference in payroll between the two groups. I would think payroll should be the same. It's just the benefits that they're going to be accruing that are going to change. In other words, I think the only change in total payroll going forward would be because the county is paying less. They're giving away a lesser benefit, so they're paying less in contributions. So it would allow them to maybe expand a little more. In other words, to hire more people. I would think the only difference in payroll 20 years from now between Tiers 4 and 5 and Tier 2 is the fact that how much this new tier is going to help the county in terms of budget and salary costs.
I guess in my mind, I'm looking at, okay, we're going to be, and who knows how everything, the economics will be, but I anticipate that the county may, instead of hiring people that pay pensions to, contract services. So you'd see more privatization.
That would be a problem.
That's where I honestly see the county going.
If that happens, then the system, us, Stan Sarah, will have to start really, we have no choice but to start investing differently.
I mean, the reality is that the kind of county that we are is the vast majority of the counties, and the way the law is set up, you can't privatize. There's only like seven or eight counties that are charter counties. Have the ability to do that. Cities, there are far more charter cities that can privatize. So the reality is you can't hire a building full of people private because of the way the law is.
But I guess, let me just put it from my perspective, my personal perspective, which I am a county employee, that services, they get most of its funding from the feds and the state in that order. So to cut costs, we have certainly been looked at as a means of privatizing. And we're significant, my department only is a significant part of the county employers. say they decided to privatize social services, that would be, you're talking about, you know, almost 1,000 employees.
What I'm telling you is you can't, they can't arbitrarily do that.
Yeah, but they could use a service contract.
Not necessarily. There may be bits and pieces of the, right, of the revenue stream that can be done.
Right.
But for the vast majority, it's not possible.
And statute.
I understand that.
Don't you think, though, that decreased pension
it's
costs
not like there's going to be less of those folks in Sacramento making those loans?
Do you think, Maria, that decreased pension costs in the future, though, would be less of a push to go that way? I don't know. I don't know the answer.
I don't know. It's part of it is that depend. It really does. It really is a bit larger, obviously, than us. It's really bigger than us here. It goes to the larger question of what role does government have in terms of not only providing services, but in paying for those services, and the taxes that go to pay those services. So there's a lot of things that could change depending as on the trickle-down effect in terms of what happens at the top federal level to the states and then to the local communities. I don't know. I honestly don't. Part of it scares me simply because it is an unknown. But I could also see where it can go a particular direction, whether I think it might work or not. That's a different thing. I could see that there will be changes. I know that there will be changes, but what will those changes look like? One of the first changes, of course, is to raise the retirement levels, raise the promises made at hiring. So all of those things are the first steps. But later on, there could be a larger change in the, again, goes to the larger, is do we have a populace that's paying into our tax base countrywide? And as you know, we're having a shrinking population, really, proportionately to what's owed. And those that will remain are earning less.
A shrinking tax-paying population.
Well, there's one other thing.
Not necessarily numbers, but...
Well, in terms of the base, you've got 100 million people that used to earn 100,000, but now they only earn 50,000, so same population.
There's one other thing you should add in there, too, is the disparity and the increasing disparity between what pensions government employees are getting and what pensions non-government employees are getting in the general populace. And I think there's going to be less and less tolerance for that disparity.
But the emotional jealousy, obviously, that is an emotional reaction.
Well, I think we can all...
I too far down the jealousy.
Emotional.
Emotional, but again,
I wouldn't call it jealousy.
I should wonder what people pay for...
I think we can all agree that there are dynamics that are out of our control. There are dynamics that are within the control of the plan sponsor, and we have to just remind ourselves of what our job is, which is fiduciaries and trustees of the retirement system.
I agree, but
and that's it.
I agree, but there are still things going on in this world that we have to be aware of, whether they're going to affect us right now. Or whether they're going to affect us later in some of the decisions that
correct.
I make.
But I think
to
we
stick
just
one's head
right.
in the ground
we,
and ignore what's
I'm
going
not
on.
I'm not sticking my head in the ground. I'm just trying to move the dialogue forward.
I would just during the member's comment, I actually have a suggestion along those lines that I want to throw out the table when we have the member's comment form, but I won't do that now.
Okay, that'll be coming up soon.
Maybe it could be a philosophical discussion
moment. Okay, thank you,
Michael.
Good presentations. Okay, I'm going to skip over the closed session for the moment and move to number 8, members forum. And we'll come back to closed session. Darren?
I don't have anything.
Joan?
What?
Members forum.
It occurred to me when I was reading the summary for the recommendation on the disability retirement today. And thinking about what staff said last time about the cost for preparing the agendas and supporting documents for these meetings, there must be a huge cost incurred in that.
In preparing the agenda item?
No, in preparing the disability reports.
There's a decent amount of cost that goes into it, yeah.
Can somebody give me a ballpark figure of what that is? We're talking...
Do you know, or is Don? Don's probably...
I mean, some of these things go on for years.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking 30, 40,000 hours in staff time?
Oh, I don't think it's that much.
That's our responsibility.
I mean, we're working right now to shore up the process and make it much more efficient. We're working with TED. There are a lot of places where we can make up some time. We're doing that, but in terms of how much we're spending on each case on average, I can bring that back to you. We can find that out.
Okay.
It shouldn't be that hard.
Thank you. I would appreciate that.
Each case. It's a case by case.
Well, give me a high and a low. And all.
One could take me 10 to 12 hours, and one can take me weeks. It just depends on what's involved in it.
Okay. So give me a dollar figure.
We'll get it for you.
Okay. Thank you.
John? Ron?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Mike?
Nothing.
Hmm?
Nothing. But I'll wait to see what Mike says.
Okay, Mike, we've all been waiting to hear what Mike has to say.
Yeah, I read an article yesterday, I think, or last night, about the San Jose pension ballot measure. And it's tied up in court, and there's been a little, anyway, but there's been some kind of election in June.
City of San Jose?
City of San Jose, which
yes.
is not 37
not the county.
One of the items that they are asking for in that election, and this is what I want to talk about, is that under a state of fiscal emergency, if the city declared a fiscal emergency, they have the authority to eliminate on a year-by-year basis the vested COLAs for the retirees that go up to 3%. And I know that we just gave 3% COLA a few months ago here. I don't know if we even have the authority, even if it's up to us or if it would be the county, if the 37 Act permitted those COLAs to be suspended. But I think as the legislature talks about retirement, and as they are now talking about a compromise between the governor's proposal and the Republican proposals, I think it's not bad to have us tell the legislators that if we agree, that we think that there should be some mechanism in cases of fiscal emergency to suspend some of those things. You know, and I think we should take a stand and let our legislators know that if that is the preference of the majority of the board. I think we need to have, and I don't know if it's the employer or if it's Dan Cerro, who needs to have that authority, but I think there has to be an amendment to the 37 Act law that says in cases of fiscal emergency, you know, the jurisdictions, either the employers or us, have some ability to exercise, take actions under an emergency basis, and they can well define what those bases are. I mean, I just think we need to let the legislature know and the governors know that, you know, we need to have, people need to have some flexibility in this. So, Rick, I'm willing to wait for you to schedule something like this on the agenda if you think we should, but or if that's the board consensus. But I think we should raise that question, and even if we don't have the authority to do it ourselves, I think we should suggest to the legislators and the governor that they, in their reform package, they not forget that this is one small little reform that might be helpful to jurisdictions.
You see what I mean? That's exactly the type of change in the game rules as you go forward that affect a lot of the stuff that we do.
It
could make a huge difference to those of us that are ending our time in the system.
And the people who are currently retired, you're right. You're right. It's
a game changer.
It has big implications for everyone involved in it. But I don't know if we live in a world that can be fixed without big changes that involve everybody.
Well, one of the issues is when they gave enhanced benefits and they didn't fund those benefits, and what you're suggesting now is people who are already retired and didn't get those enhanced benefits, the problems created by that are going to be settled on the backs of current retirees.
All I'm saying, Michael, is that I think it's an issue that should be explored to give flexibility. And how they define a fiscal emergency, I'm open. I know what you're saying. I don't disagree. I don't have an anti-sentiment to that. I'm just saying that, you know, everyone's hands are tied. Everyone is paralyzed. Nobody can do anything until you get a third appellate court decision on anything. So I think there should be more flexibility.
The way,
and
the way that I understand how the process works is that if this is something that this board wanted to pursue, then we would get somebody from Sackers to sponsor legislation and find a representative up in Sacramento to actually put this forth and get it on the 37 Act. So if this is something if we want to discuss this more at a later time, I can bring it forward in another agenda item. We can talk about the process and decide if that's what we want to do. I don't even think that it has to be agreed to by all the other 19 37 Act counties, because they can put it on the books and just not do it if they didn't want to. So it's just a matter of getting it out there, finding somebody who will sponsor this, and getting it into law.
Well, I mean, I think one of our local legislators might be willing to do that, but I wouldn't want to talk to them about it if it were not the board consensus. Right.
Is this something you want me to look into?
Well, I don't think anybody should be, first of all, I mean, I understand your position, but we shouldn't be independently representing, you know, legislation to anyone. We need to be, right. We need to be collective, and we need to operate within the association we belong to. You know, each retirement system is different. You go back east, and, you know, they've got statutes where retirees are guaranteed certain amounts of COLAs every year, and that's where they found themselves in a pickle. You've got charter systems, as Jeff Grover was pointing out, that are in the same boat, that they have guaranteed COLAs on an annualized basis, and that's what they're specifically referring to. You know, the county employee retirement law in the state of California, you have no guarantees. You can get zero. The maximum is up to 3%, but the law even allows that if you go into a negative inflation environment, you can actually take away what has been accrued.
You get the three back if you.
You can take if you go negative, whatever.
It accumulates up.
Correct. You can take that away. And actually, those discussions came up when inflation started to go potentially negative. Those discussions were brought up both in CalIPERS and Sackers as to how, you know, this is a potential looming out there. You know, we need to understand what the law reads, and they had some education training on that. So each system is different. And I, you know, I think that's the problem.
I think all I'm talking about, Darren, is another tool to meet a fiscal emergency, if we so declare there is one, or if whatever the entity is declares there is one. That's all I'm talking about. And I think the legislature should be, as they look at reform, trying to find avenues that give, like our association, our board, that kind of. Of ability to be flexible. I'm not even saying I would be for that, because I think
right.
Mike has a good point. But I think we need more flexibility. These discussions usually come down to, we'd like to do that, but we can't because of the law, the Ventura decision, blah, 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 nobody can do anything. So that's where it all just festers.
And no, I get that.
So
you know,
the other
hitch in the giddy up is the fact that, you know, that besides the normal contribution rates, you have the COLA contributions that both the employee and the employer pay besides the normal contribution. So that there's another different dynamic to this, because when you start looking at some of these other systems, they have an unfunded COLA process. So
yeah.
that creates a whole different dynamic. I don't know what San Jose has, but I know some of them that I've read, they have an unfunded COLA liability. And so it does create an interesting problem and dynamic, because no one's ever paid into it, but yet they're guaranteed these things moving forward.
I just think it's helpful for our local legislators to know where we would stand on those issues that they're all going to be voting on up there. I mean, and I don't mean that, and I'm not prepared, frankly, to defer San Sarah's position to the Sackers' position. I mean, I understand they're part of our association, but I you know, I think that there's certainly room for disagreement within associations. So that's all I'm saying. I think we should have a discussion of our participation as the responsible party for San Sarah in advising our local legislators on these issues, and I think we need to do that. And my preference is more flexibility for us, the better, within the constraints.
I would just say, if you're going to do that, you should do it sooner rather than later, because it's the topic now.
Exactly, and they've got till, they're going to do it through June 30th, and then they run another couple of months, and then it's all done one way or the other.
But I think in our county's case, Darren has a very good point. We fund our COLAs. So what you're saying is you want to stop
during
an emergency situation.
If there's a fiscal emergency, and we define
it. But we've already paid for it. We're paying for it. You see what I'm saying?
Look at the scenario that Mike is looking at. Is it okay if the retirees take that one more COLA, it puts the system in default? Is there an ability to suspend that COLA if it can be proved the system goes to default and you lose the entire thing?
Put that way, obviously, most of us would probably say okay.
Well, and I think that's all.
I'm definitely a fiscal emergency. I don't mean because we're mad at people today.
Sometimes that's what it comes down to.
I mean, unless, you know, I never voted against Joan on a COLA anyway. But
here's one for in favor of having a hearing about it on an agenda item.
Okay.
I'd like that idea.
Okay, I do too. Okay.
I want to ask another question. What is this?
Paper.
You see that? I don't know. I've not seen this.
Is that in your mail?
Yeah. It seems to me like it doesn't cover trustees anyway, so.
Your special job.
Trustees are not listed as the.
This looks like something for individuals.
I didn't get one.
Not you
want this one?
No, I don't want that. I want to give away some of what I got. Okay, staff, you have anything?
I just have a reminder. If there's paperwork that you guys don't want, go ahead and leave it in the middle of the table before you leave, and I'll throw it away.
Okay. Anything else, Rick?
That's it.
Okay. Do you have an announcement?
Yes. The following closed session items are going to be placed on each future board agenda until the items are resolved. This is in the event that information regarding these items is received within the 72-hour period after the agenda has been posted. That will allow the board members to be notified. So until these are resolved, they'll show up each time like a placeholder, per se.
So just because they're on there doesn't mean we're going
to
discuss them. It just gives us the ability to.
Okay, so we may just skip it then.
Today we
are. Okay, we're not going to today, though, so. We will now move to item 7. Is there a motion to go into closed session?
I'll move.
There's a second. Motion's been made and second. We go into closed session. All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion's passed.
Aye.
Okay. Those of you who may have a conflict of interest, we'll excuse you now.
Thanks.
It's carried. That brings us to item 9, adjournment.
We're done.
That's what item we've all been waiting for. Meeting is adjourned.
I asked the same thing too.